everybody. It's time for another edition of Fight Opinion Radio. I'm your host, Jeff Thaler, and I'm joined, as always, by Zach Arnold, the man behind Fight Opinion. Hello, Zach.
Howdy, partner. How you doing?
Well, I'm good, but you know what? We're just coming off a huge UFC. It's a big enough show that I think we need to bring in some extra commentators. And since Aaron is on vacation this week, I thought we'd tap into the Fight Opinion family and ask Tomer Chen to join us to break down the UFC. What do you say?
I'm doing well. How are you doing, guys?
I'm doing great. Listen, Tomer, we're going to have you on tonight, and then later on tonight, Zach, or in this episode, we're going to be discussing the Pro Elite show.
Well, I mean, we'll talk about the finances of Zuffa LLC with a good friend of Fight Opinion, Jeremy Goodwin, who's a certified public accountant,
And
you promised me a special guest, and I don't know who this guest is yet.
I know who it is. We will have none other than 5-time UFC champion Frank Shamrock on the show, catching up with Frank, see what he's been up to.
I really don't believe you have him.
Well, you'll have to wait and see. Let's see if I can get it rounded up. Well, listen, guys, let's talk. First thing, let's talk this UFC. Zach, you and I ripped on this card largely because the headline fight, in our opinion, was a joke. There was no way Keith Jardine was a good matchup for Chuck Liddell. They were feeding Keith Jardine to Liddell so Liddell could get another KO and move on to fight Vanderlei. And who would want to see that fight? And we were exactly right, right?
Oh, absolutely. It's even a bigger joke now that Chuck Liddell lost.
Well, now it's a joke for another reason. Tell me, you must have been shocked like us that Jardine just picked apart Liddell like that.
On one level, I think that that it was a shock just because on the basis of the quality, the wins and the losses of the two guys, Liddell had a more significant resume, but there was a few variables that made it somewhat of a question mark. First of all, the quality of his physical body. I mean, in the last fight against Rampage, he pretty much got knocked silly by Rampage in about 2 minutes with one big shot. And, in boxing, they call it old man legs when your legs start to go. And you don't really know if, he's 37, 38 years old. He's not a young guy, and he's been in a lot of wars. You don't know how much longer he had left before he started getting knocked out by every young pup that would hit him clean. So there was always a variable that Jardine could have knocked him silly if his chin started to go.
Yeah, Zach, that backs up a point I've been making for about a year now, which is that Chuck Liddell, to me, looked like he was physically breaking down. I've been making this point when he was winning, and now that he's losing, I think people might start to finally see what I'm talking about. I also
think a lot of it is just preparation. I mean, look, when you have so many guys competing at the top level in UFC and everyone's there, you got all the pride guys coming in, you have everyone else coming in, the reality is that you have to game plan better than what Chuck Liddell does. He shows up and fights. Yeah,
he got totally out game plan. But comment on the body breaking down. Are you jumping on my body breaking down bandwagon?
Oh, sure. Without question. But I would also think that a lot of this is very much preparation. And one telling statement was during the first round when Jardine towards the end started kicking him, his corner man was John Hackelman.
John Hackelman.
Yeah, told him, oh, don't worry about those leg kicks. That kind of mentality of where Chuck Liddell basically was getting picked apart by basic Muay Thai.
Yeah, now, Zach, were you surprised that Jardine was able to game plan him so well? Everybody always thinks they have a game plan for Liddell, and he seems to spoil it almost always. Yet here comes Jardine with a pretty simple game plan, He kicks to the right, right kick to the leg, right kick to the body, follow up with a punch. I mean, he seemed to know exactly where to attack Liddell and found his vulnerability.
What he did was he attacked him enough so that Liddell's counter-punching and counter-attack would not be sufficient enough to gain enough momentum. I mean, he just stalled the momentum every time he kicked them.
Tomer, let me ask you something else. I have another Chuck Liddell theory I think I've discussed on the air before, and this is years ago when he, like, for example, when he fought in Pride the first time, like against, was it Guy Metzger, Zach? And back in that era, I always thought of Chuck Liddell as a guy who hit hard but had sloppy kickboxing, and I always thought that people standing up could make him pay if he didn't catch him clean and knock him out. Now that he's slowing down a little bit, Tomer, is kind of like sloppy, unconventional. I don't want to say sloppy, but he doesn't have like a real slick movement kickboxing kind of game. He's not sloppy, but he's not slick either. Is that beginning to catch up to him?
You know, he had a very awkward kickboxing style because basically he would lob these bombs at wide angles, and in a technical sense, in a pure boxing or kickboxing match, you should be able to avoid it pretty easily. But it's MMA, and most of these people, they didn't expect to see the bomb coming from the angle that it would hit them. It was more like a Henry Armstrong in boxing or Stanley Ketchel style, where no one could see where these punches were coming from, but they had heavy power behind them. And the thing was that he also relied heavily on his pretty much for many years iron chin. You know, like in the Mesker fight, he got hit with bombs that should have decapitated him, and he actually did get dropped and nearly knocked out at one point in that fight, you know, and he was able to come back and cold cock Mesker. You know, it's just that I think that if his legs are going, like it happens to boxers all the time, you know, he's potentially losing that asset. And now he's relying on his awkward style. And if you're able to outbox him or get inside and counter him hard enough to knock him silly, then that's the end of it, you know. So his own asset may become the liability because he's become older and more broken down.
All right. And Zach, I guess if you're the UFC, you're thrilled by this stunning victory?
If you read Kevin Ioli's column on Yahoo Sports, Dana White went off on a tangent about the internet and how he hates internet websites and how all the internet websites had a pride agenda and how they were always pushing pride guys as better as UFC guys. And therefore, you know, what happened on the show with Shogun, we'll talk about that a little bit. You know, it validates the theory that UFC guys are the best, and, you know, and all the internet websites are crooked and they have their own agendas and there's things he'd like to say about them, but he can't say about them.
So he's got a star in Keith Jardine and Chuck Liddell. He's happy to see Chuck Liddell fall by the wayside, you think?
Absolutely. What are you talking about? I mean, he wouldn't drive around Chuck Liddell.
My God. We're being sarcastic, but this is pretty much a disaster. They've been trying to set up this Wanderlei Silva-Liddell fight. All he had to do, he was supposed to walk through Jardine and knock him out. That was the point of putting up a guy who would stand up and who had shown he was vulnerable to knockouts in front of him. He doesn't. The opposite happens. He does lose the fight. And now what happens to the Wanderlei Silva-Liddell fight? Who cares about that fight? If Wanderlei has looked terrible in his last two fights, about both knockouts, Liddell's looked terrible in his last two fights, both knockouts. They both appear to be guys who've already given their best years to the ring and to the cage. What happens with UFC? Where do they go in this light heavyweight division?
I guess you could book Wanderlei against Chuck. I think the best way to do it is I'd book it on the Ultimate Fighter finale before the pay-per-view. I'd book it in December. I put it on Spike TV. I'd say, okay, look, Chuck Liddell can't beat this guy on free TV, then it's over. But if he beats him, okay, he's back in title contention.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. I mean, it's interesting too, Tomer, because this comes on, this fight came directly on the heels of another big upset in the light heavyweight division. That was Forrest Griffin submitting Mauricio Shogun Hua, at the end of the third round. And Tomer, what accounts for the Pride fighters coming into the UFC and just falling flat on their face? Because here's a guy who on paper was a vicious striker, should have been able to dominate this fight on paper, yet Forrest Griffin came in, obviously extremely well prepared, and took it to Hua and wore him down. I mean, we couldn't have expected that. What happened with Shogun, and what's going on with the Pride guys?
The problem with, I'm trying to figure out what exactly happened to him, is that we don't really know if he was just not training because he didn't take Griffin seriously, or if he was, as some suggestions have made, that there was issues with the types of supplements he had been taking in the years past, like the accusations thrown by, I think, Rampage's trainer, you know, and right. Others. I mean, there's many, many questions out there that we likely will never know, or it'll take us a long time to find out what exactly happened, but from what I saw of the fight, he basically gassed out in Frank Mir style in the early part of the second round, and then Griffin just took over the fight, and, you know, he was decisively controlling him, hitting him. I think he wobbled him towards the end of the second round, and for a lot of people, a what-the-hell moment. They were just going, how can, you know, this guy who dominated the Pride middleweight division come here and basically get embarrassed like it? There's always the question of whether the Pride fighters are unaccustomed to the UFC environment, but even so, I don't think that having no stomps or soccer kicks or knees to the head of a down opponent was really a factor in this fight. It's simply that it looked like he completely gassed out. Now, whether it was due to an injury that we don't know about, like a rib injury, or to him just not training, it's just a big question mark.
Yes, it is a big question mark, Zach. I mean, I can't even remember any time in Shogun's career, including when he was fighting in Denver in a cage in the IFC all the way through his Pride career, when he ever came into a fight looking that, let's say, not lean, not in shape. And then this is a guy who would go hard for 10-minute rounds in Pride, gassing in five in the UFC.
You know, I think people talk about steroids, but I wouldn't focus necessarily on that. I'd focus on other things. I mean, you know, we talked in the Sportsline article I did a few months ago. You know, I had an agent claim that guys were getting injected with painkillers and all sorts of things. You had no idea what guys in Pride were on. I mean, they could have been on anything. And it could have been speed, meth, whatever you want to call it. You know, they could have been on something that really boosted their aggressiveness, and now we're not seeing it in UFC. And I do think it's a hard issue for Dana to address because, hey, look, if you use a blanket accusation against the Pride guys and say they're all dopers, well, that's not very fair to everyone who's a Pride fighter. But at the same token, if he comes out and says that, and he says what a lot of people are thinking and guessing out loud, what does that say about the investment he made in those guys?
It's a tough situation. But you know what? The good news is that Forrest is back on track for getting himself in contention for Dana because, A, a loss to Jardine doesn't look quite as the same as it did when he originally lost after Jardine picked apart Liddell. B, he beat Shogun, who at least most fans who've seen fights other than the UFC had pegged as number one or in the division. I mean, you know, Forrest went ahead and made himself a legitimate title contender, and maybe that's one of the few bright spots that came out of this form.
Well, it really set up Forrest against Rampage for February Super Bowl weekend, which is probably the best money matchup they've got.
Yeah, or, Zach, if Wanderlei Silva can somehow manage to break the Pride jinx and come in and look impressive in his first fight in December, whoever he ends up fighting, maybe that becomes a title fight.
I don't know. I think people are just very, very nervous about it, putting Pride guys in any sort of high position.
Yeah. Now, guys, there was a couple other big fights on the night. I got to go. I'm going to jump down to this. I think this was pure robbery. Tyson Griffin, Thiago Tavares. I can't – there's a fighter – there's a judge that gave – Tyson Griffin all three rounds when the entire second round was spent defending his back being taken, being mounted, being in an arm bar attempt. He never did one offensive thing other than, I guess, throw the guy while he was on his back standing onto his head. That's how he got the lump on the Thiago got the lump under the eye. And, yeah, how could you give him all three rounds? That's impossible. And third, what did Tyson Griffin do in that third round to win it? Because to me, again, he was mostly defending. I didn't see him really launch a lot of offense in that third round.
I thought that it was pretty much, there was one round that was pretty clear, which was Tavares's round. Then Tyson had his own round, I think the first. And then
so
the
too.
Third was, it was closer than the second or the first, but I still thought that Tavares did win. But, you know, that's the problem with judging in general, is that when you rely on the judges, you could be stuck with the MMA equivalent of Dalby Shirley, who, you know, is scoring 120 to 108 to Ray Leonard because, you know, he just likes the color of his trunks or something. You know, some of these judges, they have no idea what what the hell they're doing. They just you wonder what they're thinking.
Okay, I had a thought that came to address this judging situation. I don't think the problem necessarily is the 10-point must system, although I tend to think that there was some benefit, although there's also some difficulties with the pride model as opposed to the 10-point must. But I have my proposal, Zach. You ready for this to help?
Sure.
Minimum 6 months or minimum 9 months of jiu-jitsu or blue belt before you can become a judge for MMA fights. You got to at least have some clue as to what the hell is going on when these guys – what's a close submission? What's not a close submission? What's a danger? What's a slick move? What is it? What is a guy just holding a headlock versus when is a guy holding a guillotine choke that's a danger? I mean, that's my theory. I know it can't – it's not really serious because I doubt you can get these older judges to take it. But I wish somebody could say, go on the mat, roll for 6 months, learn what the hell you're looking at, then start judging.
What about referees?
Yeah, well, I mean, we happen to be lucky with the referees because we've two of the UFC's main referees are black belts, and another, Herb Dean's an experienced fighter. So that's three of the four main referees. I don't know Steve Mazzagatti's background. But Big John McCarthy's a black belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. Yamasaki's a black belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu.
Yeah, Yamasaki's not good.
Well, I'm just saying, I mean, at least they know what they're looking at, you know?
Well, yeah, Mario tends to look a long time when someone gets knocked down.
Yeah, and Herb Dean tends to jump in, you know, and protect the fighters much more quickly. I mean, that's just, you know, human nature. Tomer, I know it's tongue-in-cheek, this suggestion, but, I mean, what would you do to educate judges better?
The biggest problem is, to an extent, the 10-point must system isn't a bad system per se, but unlike in boxing where you can say this is a 10-8 round because a guy got knocked down and he didn't win the rest of the round, so it shouldn't be 10-9 or, you know, or something like that. A judge has to make a judgment call whether a round is too dominant by one guy or if, you know, or if it's razor thin, and they're basically discouraged from giving 10-10 rounds, draw rounds, if it's too close to tell, you know, who won the round, you know, because they're basically told it in the, from what I remember, in the Unified Rules Judge's Handbook, you know, that you should sparingly use the 10-10, but sometimes there's a 10-10 round. You just can't tell a significant difference in damage or in positional control. And another problem is also that the positional control is, I think, one of the criteria under the Unified Rules. And just because you control the guy on top doesn't mean he's not trying to control you from the bottom. And I think they need to clarify a bit the top versus bottom in terms of grappling, because, you know, it favors, to an extent, the wrestlers and the guys who can control you on top positionally. You know, they could pin you down because they consider that being dominant, whereas what if you're Nogueira, who's going for 20 submissions from the bottom and you're pretty successful for the most part on them? It's not just half passing these submissions. They could do a lot more to detail how exactly to measure each round. I mean, they do an okay job, but it's too vague because they have, I think, only three or four criteria, and they're pretty vague criteria. So they
and that transitions
really
beautifully into the John Fitch Diego Sanchez fight, because Sanchez was making all these submission attempts where he's getting nowhere with them, and Fitch, for defending the submission attempts, ended up winning on the scorecard.
Yeah, now, first of all, let me say this. Goldberg, I can't believe he actually said this. It was one of the stupidest things I've ever heard. Should you get as much credit for escaping a submission as being caught, nearly caught in one? That's like asking the guy, does the guy get more credit because he got up after a knockdown? Or do we, you know, does he much? I mean, you know, you almost got knocked out, the equivalent of a submission. You don't get as much credit for escaping. That's ridiculous. But this is a bit of the same problem, although I didn't think Sanchez really was as dominant, nearly as dominant in terms of both position and submission attempts as Tavares. But this is another case where it's very close. I think Tomer, you hit on a good point, and it kind of relates to what I was saying, that if you don't understand jiu-jitsu, you don't know when the guy on the bottom in the guard or half guard is winning sometimes. You know, I saw things on the bottom where the guy on the bottom looks like he's winning that exchange on the bottom. But, you know, somebody who's not as educated, he doesn't understand the way the hips are moving, the way the control is going, the way he's putting the other fighter in danger may not see it that way. And I think we had a bit of that in this fight, although I think this was a little bit tighter decision and a little more justifiable, Zach, than the Tavares decision. Against.
I would agree, although, you know, certainly you can argue either way, and certainly a lot of people were arguing after that match.
Yeah. Tomer, do we need to at least add in another criteria, the Pride criteria, attempt to finish the fight? Maybe that was a big criteria for Pride, and yet, and if we gave that in the UFC, we might see a little bit better result, or would we?
Well, the biggest problem, and it's been brought up before by other people, most notably, I remember Jordan Breen discussing it several times, you know, what exactly does that criteria mean? I mean, it means you're trying to finish the fight, but how can you tell that that guillotine is 37% locked, cinched in, and that one is only 28%? You know, how can you relatively measure the success of it unless it's like a deep, deep, clearly deep choke or, you know, deeply cinched armbar or something when you're like half-assing and both of them are half-assing the submissions? How do you award the rounds? Pretty much at that point, you have to throw up your hands and say, fine, 10-10, because I don't know.
Oh, well, on that criteria, yes, but then if you get a fight where one fighter is hiding in the guard and the other one's going from Kimura to guillotine to armbar to sweep attempt, you know, I mean, well, not sweep to finish.
Well,
But all right, so listen, we're running short on time. I think we see that there's a lot of controversy in this evening fight. Definitely a big turning point for the UFC. And before we go though, Zach, there was another 205 pounder who, although he was fighting Nakamura, a perennial, not very successful fighter, did look good. And he's been criticized for not trying to finish, but at least in this fight, he showed good aggression and mixed it up. And that's, Lyoto Machida.
Yeah. He just wins. That's all he ever does. He just wins.
But he looked decent in this fight. But he knocked out Franklin. That was a good thing. But he looked decent in this fight compared to some of the other boring fights he's had in the UFC and the WFA.
Yeah, but you know, I think people are too hard on him because he's in that damn if you do, damn if you don't mold, where if he doesn't change his fight style, people are going to criticize him forever for being boring. But if he changes his fight style, then he risks losing.
Yep.
I mean, cause he fights a very smart game plan every time he goes out there.
But I didn't think he was boring this fight. Tomer, was he boring this fight?
You know, I don't think he was being boring. Maybe to the, you know, to the super casual fan that's looking at it the first or second time, they may have not been impressed by him because he, you know, his game style is more methodical. He's not going out there lobbing bombs in every direction, hoping to knock out his opponent or trying to quickly choke the guy out or something. But, you know, I thought he was, you know, he's had far worse looking performances I can think of. I think the Vernon White fight from WFA, I believe it was, where that was just horrendous. You know, he's had some bad performances. This wasn't a bad performance. It's just not, wow, you're crushing your opponents with ease, because, you know, a lot of people, you know, point to the destruction of Rich Franklin when they discuss him, because most of his other wins are less than crushing, I guess what I would say. That's his most significant defeat win, I mean, in terms of the actual way that he won the fight, whereas he had struggles with BJ Penn, who was a bloated lightweight.
Well, I think a lot of people would struggle with BJ no matter the weight, just because he's so talented.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe not Fedor, but you know, even at 205, he's enough to be difficult. I just want to leave. I want to thank you, Tomer, for joining us and filling in and taking Aaron's spot. Did a very admirable job. Thank you. I know we caught you in the middle of a busy day, so we appreciate you catching up with us.
Thanks again.
And Zach, I'm going to leave this segment with one quick comment, which is, Matt Hughes and Chuck Liddell have always said they weren't worried about negotiating everything down to the last penny because the UFC would always take care of them. We're going to find out, because Chuck Liddell is in a position where the UFC may not take care of him if he keeps losing. And we'll see if the loyalty to Dana pays off or if you're better bargaining for the last penny. My thoughts for the future. Stay tuned. When we come back, Zach, let's talk a little more fight.
Pro Elite, Hawaii Big Show. But of course, according to Kevin Ioli, Pro Elite is just the AAA.
Well, Kevin's entitled to his opinions. We will be back in a minute because we have our own opinions here on Fight Opinion Radio.
It's not easy being an MMA fan. You arrive to work again with your face noticeably affected by the training session you had last night.
Henderson! Where'd you get that black eye? Have you been rolling around with sweaty men again?
Well, we can't stop your boss from being a dick, but we can give you an awesome place to spend your otherwise painful hours at your desk every day. At MMAPredictions.com, you can check out the latest MMA news, smack talk on the forums, and make and track your predictions on upcoming MMA fights. If only we could arrange a match between you and your boss.
Henderson!
MMAPredictions.com. Pick, share, compare, win.
Are you a fight fan? Kakuto.com offers the best memorabilia from K1, Pride, Zero One, New Japan Pro Wrestling, and so much more. Japanese goods, Japanese prices. That means you pay what a customer pays in Japan. You can't beat it. www.kakuto.com. That's www.kakuto.com.
Do you train mixed martial arts, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, Muay Thai, grappling, boxing, or wrestling? OTM Fight Shop has everything you need to be a pro fighter. Gloves, gis, protective gear, training DVDs, bags, equipment, fightwear, and more. There is an OTM Fight Shop near you. Check out OTMFightShop.com.
I tell you, September has been a hell of a month. If you're a fan of MMA, there's been a lot of stuff, a lot of content, a lot of action going on. It's really overwhelming in a sense.
This is what I want to talk about tonight. Let's see if you're cool with this. You ready?
Okay.
I want to talk about Elite XC's big show in Hawaii.
Sure.
I want to talk about UFC Ultimate Fight Night 11.
Okay.
I want to talk about the Ultimate Fighter season debut. I want to track down Frank Shamrock and speak to him live on the show.
Why? How'd you do this?
I'm going to manage it. I want to also delve into a topic that's been skimmed over very lightly on the MMA blogs, but something that you and I spent some time digging into in depth this weekend, and that is some very interesting news about the finances of mixed martial arts that came up this weekend, including some big news about Zuffa taking out major loans.
I don't know about you, but I think the fightopinion.com line of credit is about $200 million for Sushik.
Well, you know, based on the UFC, we might be. And then, of course, Zach, what would our show be if we didn't end it with?
The World Famous Grab Bag, the highest quarter-hour rated segment in all of MMA radio. It's the best.
It is the best. It is the best. But let's talk about who is the best 185-pounder in the world. We had the Elite XC show this past weekend, and Robbie Lawler, who I had as an underdog, came in and brutally knocked out Ninja Hua to win the title in Elite XC. Is he a threat as the number one fighter in 185 in the world?
I would say no, but he's certainly in the top five now, and he fought a quality fighter in Ninja. Most people actually predicted this right on the internet. Most people actually thought Waller would tire him out and knock him out, and he did that. And I was still kind of surprised by it, because Ninja is a game fighter and he's a hard puncher. But you know, people like Luke Thomas predicted that Ninja, you know, could get hurt, and he did get hurt. And Waller, you know, you got to realize, when I first saw Waller fight, you know, we saw him fight at a very early age. He was fighting in UFC against guys like Aaron Riley and Nick Diaz. And you got to think about that. I mean, that was, what, 4 or 5 years ago?
Yeah.
I mean, he's still a very young guy.
Yeah, he is. But, you know, I watched that fight. I was a little surprised, because to me, Hua looked, I don't know, stiff or mechanical. He didn't look like a fluid shootbox guy that we'd seen so many times in Pride. He kind of looked like awkward, frankly. It didn't look like.
Yeah, no. But, you know, it's funny, because since Pride's been gone, you know, the whole scene in Brazil has really changed. I mean, in terms of the teams and the organizations, it seems a lot of things have really fallen apart.
Yeah, and I guess he may be subject to that. I mean, he doesn't get to train with Vonderlei anymore, since Vonderlei's in
Florida.
In Florida, but he's also moving in to train with Randy Couture, I thought, in Vegas.
going back and forth, but I mean, it's like, you know, I think Ninja's in L.A., is he not?
I don't even know. I haven't heard that he's here, but he might be. But then could maybe to train with his brother. He's got his UFC debut. I don't know. But a very big win for Robbie Lawler. He really absorbed some punishment and just warmed down, and then just a brutal knockout.
That was a brutal knockout, and that was interesting to see that. I'm curious to see where they're going to position him next. I mean, who are they going to get? Because you look at the 185 division, UFC has enough problems trying to get enough talent in that division. Where's Pro League going to get their talent?
Oh, that's a very good question. I don't know, but congratulations to Robbie Lawler, for sure, right?
Absolutely.
And by the way, did you see Mario Yamasaki during that show? He kind of let that fight go a little longer than I might have, but did you look at him closely during that show?
Yes, I did. I don't think that really changed either on the Ultimate Fighter or the Ultimate Fight Night show.
He had that kind of...
He was working.
I mean, we were joking about it. I mean, I obviously...
There were some quite controversial finishes in his matchup.
Yeah. Hey, you know what else was controversial? Was that Nick Diaz fight, because he took on Hawaiian Mike Aina. And
that was, by the way, I got to say something. That was a horrible matchmaking deal. I mean, you know, they take this guy who I don't want to call him a no-namer, but to the casual public, nobody knows who he is.
Right.
He has a similar style to Nick Diaz. So it was right for the upset. I mean, the only thing going for Pro Elite in booking that fight was, okay, he's a local Hawaiian guy, therefore the crowd would cheer for him. But, I mean, you could have found somebody else who was local in Hawaii who Diaz could have easily beat. Instead, they pick this guy who's relatively unknown, and he gives Diaz a ton of hits.
Yeah, and not only that, but what happened to Diaz's punching? I mean, the guy looked like he was just playing pity-pat on his face.
Well, he does that all the time.
But this was like a new level.
You know, when you hear people like Cecil, you know, judges like Cecil Peoples, and they talk about, you know, well, connecting, you know, counts. And, you know, Diaz, he does it for scoring as opposed to actually effectiveness.
But this is the same guy who knocked out Robbie Lawler when Lawler was in a lower weight class. I mean, he has power. He has connected and hurt people. So,
well, I know, and he's shown it against Takanori Gomi, too.
Right, of course, against Gomi as well. So, to me, it was just very puzzling. It's like he complained of jet lag, and then he came over because he came over to Hawaii, and I hope that's what it was, because, honest to goodness, Nick Diaz, if he punches like that, that's just a
It was just a bad setup by Pro League to put him in that fight, coming off the suspension, and it was just not a great performance.
No. What about bad setups? You want to talk about bad setups for a second?
Sure.
How about our friend Marlon Ronaldo's setup during the Gina Carano-Tanya Evinger fight?
There's a lot to that story, and I think a lot more is going to be unfolding in the next week or two.
Well, now fill in the people as to what you can tell us now.
They were it was Bill Goldberg, Stephen Quadros, and Mauro Ranallo doing commentary for the Gina Carano-Tanya Evinger fight. Tanya Evinger, in the press conferences leading up to the fight, was doing a lot of sexual innuendo.
Lesbian and, sexual innuendo.
Yes. Bill Goldberg said that he didn't want to touch the subject with a 25-foot ball, when Mauro Ranallo made the comment that drew a lot of heat internally. He said that he'd like to touch Gina Carano with a 25-centimeter pole.
Or at least the topic, I think he said, yes. It was definitely not appropriate. maybe it was planned. Maybe it just came out. It wasn't appropriate. First of all, I guess, you know, it tells you something about the tolerance between homosexuality, between gay men and lesbians. Because if a man said, I don't know whether I want to, you know, bang my opponent in the butt or take his back and choke him, that would be probably the most unpopular fighter in the history of fighting.
Oh, people would be horrified. They'd be like, how dare him do that?
Yeah, right. You know, that's gross. I would never get on the mat. I wouldn't let him in the ring. Who could spar? Who could train with him? And yet Tanya Evinger, you know, she's getting everybody kind of interested just by saying this. So I guess it just tells you a little bit about how we treat homosexuality different based on who's making the statement.
I also think it says a lot about Tanya Evinger in terms of the positioning, the weak positioning she was put into this fight. And I'll tell you how. Look at the fight itself. You know, here's Gina Carano. She doesn't make weight, for real, even though they claim she did. She gets on the scale with 1 foot.
On the scale with 1 foot makes no difference. Your whole weight's on that foot, isn't it?
Well, she was trying to do a balancing act, and she got off very quickly. And, you know, the deal is she claims she was on her period.
Yeah, I know.
But, I mean, you know, if I'm the agent for Tonya Evinger, I would have not only refused to take the fight after that stunt, I would have sued her.
Well, I don't know if you could sue Gina Carano. You could definitely refuse to take the fight.
You could sue. Yes, you can.
What is she going to sue Gina Carano for? She's going to
get. We've seen this in boxing. You know, suing for breach of contract.
Yeah, but she doesn't sue. Well, she may get some of her purse or something, I guess. I don't know. Whatever. Gina Carano did make weight. I guess she ended up being off by 0.1 pound, which they claimed would.
Well, no, the deal was it was supposed to be a catch weight of 140 pounds.
Right, and then
Gina Carano shows up at 141.1, and that was with her stunts on the scale. And, you know, Tonya Evinger's like, it was supposed to be 140. There's not supposed to be any other exception. You know, it was not the 1 pound rule difference. Over,
oh, they don't have that in a catchweight fight? I thought that rule would just carry out. Oh.
No, it's supposed to be dead on.
Well, then I'll tell you what, Gina Carano should have given up at least half her purse to Tonya Evinger. But that's how I would have done it if I was the.
Well, you know, and that's the thing about this that makes it stink because, you know, Tonya Evinger is not in a position to refuse the fight because where else is she going to get money from?
No.
She's not going to find anywhere else to make money. Mm-mm. Yeah, so she's screwed.
Right. And then she went, well, anyway, and then she went for the fight. She went for a really bad guillotine choke that she shouldn't have gone for. She gave up her back and. End of fight, huh? It was definitely a person who on paper looked like she might be dangerous, but in the end, you got to think Gina Carano was a bit protected.
But here's the problem I have, and I'm going to make a wrestling comparison, and people are going to hate this.
All right, I hate it already.
The way people are in Pro Elite are pushing Gina Carano is the same way that WWE forces John Cena down the throat of every wrestling fan, and the wrestling fans turn on him every time he comes out, and they yell at him and say he sucks. And they don't like the promotion pushing him down their throats. I mean, it's the same deal with Gina Carano. Essentially, what's going to happen is they're going to push her so hard, and they're going to put her in positions where people are going to say, you know, she's just a sideshow. She's like the Anna Kournikova, you know, of MMA. And they're going to, you know, they're risking themselves by putting themselves in a position where they make it so transparent that she's their golden girl. That, you know, people are going to be more and more skeptical as opposed to actually more and more respecting her.
Well, she's going to be like the Christy Martin. Remember her? She was boxing's golden girl, and she kind of...
Well, Christy Martin was from West Virginia. She was, you know, Mia St. John is the one that had all the looks and did the Playboy thing.
But Christy Martin was the one that they pushed and who they, you know, were accused of protecting. But, you know, I don't see fans turning on Gina yet. I don't see that yet. Maybe you're right.
No, but, I mean, people are going to be more and more skeptical when they see Gary Shaw come in the cage every time and hug her. And
what,
like,
and kiss her?
You know, I mean, like, they're practically – there's a difference between pushing someone who's good and practically building an entire foundation around them to the point where people sit there and question the credibility of it.
All right. Hey, listen, there's another guy that was on the fight that you cannot question his credibility whatsoever. This is a guy that ought to be – you know, fighting the most in the elite. I don't know why the UFC has let him go, and that is Jake Shields, because he destroyed Trudeau.
That was a ridiculous beating. By the way, that was the Mario Yamazaki special if I ever saw one.
Yeah, I mean, Trudeau just, you know, sitting there mounted, just eating blows, grimacing, and, you know, no answer and no stoppage. I mean, but
I keep hearing this argument on the internet that, you know, Cerruto doesn't mean anything anymore. He's washed up and this fight was a joke and Jake Shields not in UFC, but he's not marketable. You know, I sit there and I go, why isn't he in UFC? If UFC always says they have world-class fighters and they have the world's best, why isn't this guy in their league?
Yeah, it's a terrible mistake to not have him in the UFC. And if you think that Trudeau stuff is a joke, no. You know what? To get him on the ground and to mount him like that and to hold the mount on a really good black belt like that, that's not a joke.
That guy is great. Jake Shields is fantastic.
Yeah, and this guy, I mean, he's a friend of the show. He's been on the show. We've spoken to him. A very interesting personality. A different story than most fighters, being that he's a vegetarian.
Well, and think about some of the quality wins he's had in his career. I mean, he's fought in Shudo. He's fought every. I mean, he's fought everywhere but UFC. And
yeah,
he's always won.
Yeah. Now I remember the guy from way back in the day, from like around 2000. When he was fighting out of Chuck Liddell's camp, and he was kind of winning some and losing some, and he was losing to guys from Cesar Gracie's school until he moved up north to go to school up there, and he started training with Cesar Gracie, and his career turned around. And I guess people were still thinking of him as maybe he's mediocre, maybe he'll be something, and then he goes out in 2002 and beats Sakurai, and that shocked the world, and he's just been on a tear ever since then.
And speaking of which, Hayato Sakurai, one of the guys in Pride that people thought was going to come to UFC when the Pride asset sale happened, he's not.
That sucks.
He is going to be doing a shoot boxing event on October 28th in Tokyo, which is an affiliation loosely connected to K1. So it looks like another Japanese talent not coming to UFC. And, you know, just another chink in the armor for what was a terrible business deal overall.
Yeah, depending on what they paid, yes. So listen, all right, the only other fight we saw on that card was Joey Villasenor, close decision, beat Fukuda.
Ricky Fukuda, who came from pro wrestling.
And there's really not – yeah, exactly. That's all I have to say about that fight. And then
why'd you hate that fight?
I don't hate that fight. I just – you know, it was a close fight. They fought each other. They went at it. They showed a lot of guts, but it, you know, just – I don't know. Left me a little flat. I don't know why.
What's your hate?
No hate. I actually like Joey Villasenor. He's another guy that used to fight down in Fresno in the IFC back in the around 2000.
Okay.
So I like him. He's a guy I've been watching from since, you know, 7 years. So.
Yeah, you know, you fought in King of the Cage, by the way, King of the Cage and Icon and all sorts of promoters.
He fought
out by Pro Elite.
He fought King of the Cage. He fought Crazy Tim Credor in one of his King of the Cage fights. Crazy Tim Credor is a guy that I fought in a BJJ tournament and who armlocked me. And then immediately after armlocking me, got promoted to his next belt level, which I looked at his coach and I was thinking about it. And was going, why couldn't he just done it before the tournament? Then I could have won. So, but he's a very good jiu-jitsu black belt and he fought Joey Villasenor in that fight, and you know Joey mounted him and took him out. So he's a good fighter. He's kind of fallen down on some of the biggest stages. He got knocked out in Pride. He got knocked out by Ninja, and I just don't see him. You know, he's the other guy at 185, and I don't see him getting a title shot anytime soon based on being knocked out by Ninja. Guess what? You know what? Pro Elite was not the only show this last week.
Oh God, no! I mean, how much content have we had over the last couple weeks?
Mike, well, after the August lull, this is actually kind of refreshing. We had the Ultimate Fighter debut in the Ultimate Fight Night this last week.
Yeah, and Kenny Florian, another win.
Kenny Florian with a very impressive win, actually.
I mean, you see impressive win, but like on the internet, he is the most hated person. I don't get it.
Why is he hated? I haven't.
Like people think he always wins luck by luck, or by freak accidents, or you know, like people don't respect him.
Oh, because Din Thomas hurt his knee shooting in.
Yeah, and the whole elbow deal, and it's like people don't give him enough respect.
Well, I'll tell you something. This is a guy who's really transformed himself as a fighter.
He has.
Yeah, and he looked very impressive in beating Dean Thomas. I actually thought that was going to be a much more competitive fight. I thought Dean had the boxing ability to stay with him. He didn't. Kenny Florian was picking him apart with kicks and Muay Thai. And I thought Dean, if they went to the ground, could match him, and he couldn't. When he got on top of Kenny Florian, he couldn't do squat. When Kenny Florian got on top of him, Dean got in trouble.
Of course, Dean blew his knee out.
Yeah, and Dean blew his knee out, which is bad luck for Dean. But very good fortune for Kenny. The problem for Kenny is if the muscle shark gets through his drug testing results and gets to fight again, the muscle shark beats him 10 times out of 10 because the muscle shark will hold him down and pound him out.
I don't think we're going to see that happen.
Yeah, and that's the problem Kenny Florian faces. But I got to give him a lot of credit because he's transformed as a fighter. And there was another guy, you know, when another guy transformed, he went down to 185, and that was Terry Martin, and he talked a lot of mess about how nobody could beat him. And Chris Levin came in and knocked his ass out.
Yeah, Terry Martin did not look in good shape.
No, he didn't. It looked like he thought it was an easy fight and he could walk through him because he was gassing in the first round.
Well, you know, the thing about Chris Levin is that at times he's such an underachiever, and then other times he's an overachiever. I mean, there's no balance with this guy.
No, there isn't, but I'll tell you something. For a while, Chris Levin was the guy I like to see get knocked out. I don't know, for some reason he rubbed me the wrong way or whatever.
Oh yeah.
But now I'm kind of now that he's an underdog, I'm pulling for again. And now Terry Martin was a guy I like to see get knocked out just because he'd had two easy fights and he, you know, was so confident in himself and it just confidence that kind of rubbed me in a weird way. And And so
it was a sloppy fight, but I'll give Leben credit. I mean, that was an incredible finish.
Yeah, and he should have submitted him the round before. I mean, he came very close.
But, of course, he grabbed the cage in the first round and got lost a point.
Yeah. Well, anyways, it was good. Good win for Chris Leben. And then Nathan Diaz, very impressive.
That was what impressed me the most on the night was, he's facing Junior. And, I thought that was going to be a much tougher fight, but it wasn't. He picked him apart pretty easily.
Yeah, and he submitted him pretty easily. I mean, it was a very nice guillotine. And I don't know if you caught it, but at the very end of the guillotine, he switched from arm in and then switched to just on the neck without the arm in anymore. And that's what finished the fight. And I'll tell you what I enjoyed about that fight was watching, it's hard for people to appreciate, but when they were moving on the ground and it looked like one guy had the other's back and they did takedowns and flew around. That kind of fluid movement you only see with two really good jiu-jitsu players. And it was really nice to see.
I totally agree with that. It was a fun fight.
It was a fun fight. And I guess another fight that was, kind of a slugfest, a little bit sloppy, but fun. Nathan Quarry knocked out Pete Sell.
I kind of worry for Nate Quarry because he got rocked a couple of times here. It didn't look like he changed his fight style much at all, and I don't think he could hang.
No. And for Pete Sell, here was a guy that at one point was, about 8-0? And he had beaten Phil Baroni, and he looked like he had a really, really, really bright future. And now he's just an opponent at this point. I mean,
Pete Sell's in that position where he's kind of in that weird position where he's a TV guy, but he's not going to be a pay-per-view guy. I mean, in other words, he's the kind of guy who, if you're facing a Scott Smith or a Nate Quarry, he's always going to bring it. But he's not a pay-per-view level caliber fighter.
No, and you know what, Pete? You know, he's really become like a stand-up fighter, but he started his career with Matt Serra. That's jiu-jitsu, and I keep wondering, when are we going to see Pete Sell, the animal jiu-jitsu guy who takes you down, gets on top, and finishes the fight?
Yeah, we have not seen that. I mean, when you look at the fight he had against Nate Quarry here, I mean, he was content to absolutely stand up the entire time. And, I mean, he rocked Quarry.
Yeah, he dropped him.
And, I had to be very concerned about if I'm at Nate Quarry's camp because this guy, if he gets in there with a real elite fighter, he's in so much trouble.
Yeah, and a fight that didn't make the air, but we're sad to report, friend of the show, Jonathan Goulet, was not successful in this fight against
What happened there?
Submission, armbar, round one.
I mean, what the heck happened? I mean, he was going to be fighting in the main event against Mike Swick.
I don't know. It's unfortunate for Jonathan.
That was bad.
That was bad. I haven't seen the fight. It wasn't on the TV. I don't know. It's probably on the UFC On Demand. Maybe you've seen it already, but I haven't seen it yet. So,
not good.
Not good. Not good. And then we had the debut of Ultimate Fighter Season 6, Sarah versus Hughes. Or is it Hughes versus Sarah?
Jesus.
Well, I didn't see this yet. I have it on my DVR, my digital video recorder. I'm going to watch it after our podcast. Was it good?
It's more the same. You know, they seem to be a little bit more focused on the broadcast this year, a little bit tighter on the editing. They had a fighter named Roman who, during the two-hour, inspection process, he broke his elbow. So he went to the doctor. The doctor told him his elbow was broken. He wouldn't let him fight. And the Armenian did not have a very good temper, and he threw a big temper tantrum at the doctor's office.
I think that when I used to work out at Gokor Trevichian's gym, which is where Caro Parisian and Monville or Manny from Gamburian from the last show both worked out there at that time, and I think Roman was there too, and he was a young kid. He's a few years younger than Manny and Caro, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was a tough kid. You could tell back then he was going to be a tough kid. I'm sure he's a tough guy now. But
he wanted to kill the doctor.
What are you going to do? Broken elbow.
I know, and he's like, I'm not doing it. He was very, it was very unprofessional at a doctor's office to kick things around.
Wow, he kicked things around. That's nice. So it looks like we're in for another season of madness.
Pretty much.
All right.
Other than Mac Danzig won his first fight and won pretty easily.
Mac, by the way, was trying to get on that show the season before. Do you know this story?
Because he couldn't get in because of the King of the Cage contract.
We talked about that on the air, didn't we?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, with Mac. So that's good. So good he got on the show. Good he was successful. He's a good local kid from here in L.A. We like to see them do well. Just like just like we would have liked to see Roman do well, another local kid from LA via Armenia, but I guess not to be for Roman this season, huh? If I told you that by the time we get back from our break, I could track down and get on the phone the legendary five-time UFC champion Frank Shamrock for an interview exclusive with Fight Opinion, what would you say?
I would say he's a big fan of mine.
What?
I would say he's a very big fan of mine then.
Okay, well, maybe he's a fan of ours, Zach. You know, it's not Zach Arnold Radio, it's Fight Opinion Radio, my friend.
Okay.
Maybe he's our fan.
You can believe that if you want.
Well, why not? All right, so listen, when we come back, I promise I will have tracked down and have on the phone with us the one, the only, Frank Shamrock for an exclusive Fight Opinion Radio interview.
Looking to buy a ring for your wrestling, boxing, or MMA promotion?
Unleash a monster!
Are you looking for a cage, steel security rails, vinyl canvas and mat covers, a ring belt, or a ring trailer?
Unleash a monster.
Are you looking for a 6- or 8-sided ring? Do you want your own custom design?
Unleash a monster.
Monster Wrestling and Boxing Rings is your complete source for all kinds of rings and accessories. If your business is wrestling, boxing, or MMA, if you need a complete ring, a custom design, or even a do-it-yourself kit, then...
Unleash a monster.
Monster rings are used by large promotions, independent promotions, training centers, movie studios, television companies, video game companies, churches, government agencies, nightclubs, bars, youth leagues, martial arts studios, and individuals around the world. Monster Rings sells more rings than all their competitors combined. So,
unleash a monster.
Head to MonsterWrestlingRings.com and explore all the options. Forget the rest. Buy from the best. MonsterWrestlingRings.com.
Unleash a monster.
Today.
Hi, I'm Boss Rutten. Do you ever dream about fighting in a ring? If you do, well, this is your chance because the IFL is looking for new and fresh MMA talent for its 2008 season.
Can you feel it?
So if you are an experienced mixed martial artist and looking to pursue a professional fighting career, the IFL wants you. Now, this October, the IFL and LA Boxing will host their first ever draft for MMA athletes at 3 LA Boxing locations across the United States. At each location, there will be an IFL coach present scouting for new talent. That means you better sign up now. But where do you sign up? Please go to IFL.tv or LAboxing.com. Please don't miss out to be the next IFL superstar.
Fight Opinion Radio, you and me.
Yeah, and we have a guest that was involved in a fight that I saw last June in San Jose that had so much heat and so much crowd reaction. It was a fantastic fight, and this man just laid a beating on Phil Baroni, and it was incredible to watch.
Well, there can only be one man who laid a beating on Phil Baroni in June in Strikeforce, and that would be Frank Shamrock. Frank Shamrock, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Oh, no, thanks for joining us. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic, man. Just working 12-hour day and kicks some butt, so I'm feeling good.
All right. Well, Frank, my first question for you is you went in that Phil Baroni fight with a bum knee. You came out kind of not any worse for wear, but how is the knee and how are you looking coming down the road?
Well, I tore my – about 2 weeks before, I tore my ACL, MCL, and PCL and strained my meniscus and – Well, the gist of that is I tore all the tendons out of my left knee. And right now I just got cleared about 2 weeks ago to do pretty much anything I want. I spent about 2.5 months in some very serious rehab and I rebuilt, my entire knee.
Well, so that's amazing. So you, for 2.5 months, you couldn't exercise yet. You could go out and fight at a high level competition and defeat.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I don't know exactly how it works, but as soon as I got out of the fight, it took about a week off, and I went right into rehab and rebuilt the entire thing. But, you know, I heard it about 3 weeks before, and I through icing and relaxing and, you know, not going really, really hard, I was able to heal up the meniscus most of the way before the match, and then just went out and did my business.
All right, well, let's walk us through that fight for a little bit. You and Phil Baroni had kind of been going back and forth for many months. You had put out some videos kind of insulting Phil. Phil had explained to the whole world that you were a bum and he was going to knock you out. And then you finally got in the ring, and, boy, we saw some fireworks. Walk us through that fight for us, if you would.
Sure. Well, I knew he was coming, and he was coming hard for me because I knew that he was pretty confident in himself. And I really felt like I had to take that away. So, you know, usually I come out kicking, but my legs weren't working. So I came out punching. And the first couple of shots, he was just throwing massive power from the first punches. And I could feel that he was really trying to just smack me around. So I kind of relaxed and just moved around and picked him apart with punching and counter punching. And, you know, about a minute in, I really felt like I had him, and I thought I could just smoke him, knock him out.
And that's why you gave us the night-night symbol?
Yeah, so I gave him the "I'm putting you to sleep" sign. And, cause I know a lot about striking, and I felt like I had his timing and I had his range. And, you know, I knew by mocking him, it would make him stiffer and more upset and more frustrated. And that was a big part of my psychological game. I could have swore I was going to knock him out, and knock him down with a couple of, counter right hand, left hook, right hand. And, I could have swore he was sleeping, but he popped right back up after I jumped on and started choking him and came back to life. And then, we sort of scrambled on the ground a little bit. I tried a guillotine choke, which didn't work all that well. And then for whatever reason, I started hitting him in the back of the head. I don't really know why. They gave us a restart, and this was about 2.5 minutes in, and then the slugfest began. And it went down, you know, uphill or downhill from there, depending on how you look at it.
Now, coming out of that fight, it was amazing to see the crowd reaction, because they really reacted to you as a major league star. I mean, it was a great reaction. And just, you know, sometimes you watch some fights on, like, on UFC, and it's like the crowd, you know, they react to the finish, but they don't really react to the fighter. I mean, but it's like with you, it was, wow, it was that major star factor. When you're watching on TV, it was pretty incredible to watch. What was the atmosphere like at San Jose Arena when you fought there?
Well, it was just amazing. And there's a couple reasons, you know. The biggest one is this is my hometown. I'm from San Jose. And the second one is it's a martial arts community, you know, and Phil was really the, you know, the obnoxious outside kind of, you know, meathead kind of guy that, you know, really brings the animosity out in people, and it brings the energy out of the martial artists. And, man, you know, the first time I fought there, we sold 18,000 seats. When I walked into that arena, I mean, it was like my soul was vibrating with the energy. And when I came out to this fight, it was even more intense because people were so into the storyline. They were so into, you know, the truth behind the fight. And it really was, you know, a young dog taking on one of the older dogs. And, you know, people saw it as a potential passing of the torch situation. You know, when the old martial artist warrior came out on top, it brought the house down.
Now, coming out of that fight, you certainly left a lot of options on the table open, because I'm sure you're in high demand, and it will be interesting to see where you fight next. Do you have any certain plans yet in cement as far as where you're going to fight and when and who do you want to fight?
You know, I don't really know where. I got a couple of fights that I'd like to get out of the way. One of them is the Henzo fight, and I think he robbed the fans on that one, and I want to give that back to him. I've got Kung Lee. I'm going to knock him out in 08. That's kind of just a fun thing I want to do. And then
just a fun thing, Just for kicks.
Yeah, well, Kung and I are old friends. He was my sparring partner for years. Actually, I was his sparring partner because he would never do my style. I just did his for him. So, you know, in San Jose, we're the two biggest martial artists that there is. You know, and they'll just die for that fight. But I don't, you know, he's not going to, there's no way he can beat him. I mean, you never know, but
right.
I'm not that worried about it. And then I'm hoping to get another, or like Tito's hoping to get another crack at me late in the 08. So,
they're saying he's about to re-sign with the UFC. Does that mean there's a chance you're going to kind of bury the hatchet and end your feud with the management of the UFC?
I don't know about that. I don't know if he'll re-sign. You know, I think Tito's done as a fighter. I don't think he has it mentally anymore. And, you know, fighting is 90% mental, and I just think he's done in that way. So, you know, I see him needing something to bring his career back to life again, and a win over Frank Shamrock, you know, would do that for him.
The immediate question, though, that comes to mind when you talk about that, Frank, besides where the hell would you fight, in which promotion, the second question is, what are you going to do about the weight difference? Now, when you fought originally, it was back, frankly, in a different era when there was no weight class for 185. It's either you fought 205 or you fought unlimited. But now you're squarely in a different weight class, and he cuts a lot to make 205. Are you willing to move up in weight? I mean, I don't think he can move down.
But you know what? My personal opinion is this. You know, I started when there were no weight classes. I fought guys up to 260 pounds. And when I fought Tito, he walked in at 220 pounds. So he's the same size as he was when I fought him last time. You know, size doesn't mean much to me. You know, it doesn't matter what weight. I can't get any bigger, unfortunately, unless I do something, you know, steroids or whatever. And I'm certainly never going to do that. I weigh, you know, 192 pounds, and I've always fought at that weight. So I'll fight him at whatever weight. It doesn't matter to me. Tito's deathly afraid of me punching him in the head, and he knows it. So.
Oh, all right. Well, there you go. I want to take you back just for a second to you mentioned that you want to rematch with Renzo Gracie. Now, when we saw that fight, I guess I take it from you, your opinion is that Renzo really wasn't as hurt as he made himself out to be. But Frank, I gotta be honest, when I looked at him, he had the glassy eyed look of a guy who had suffered, suffered a concussion.
All I know is I hit Phil Baroni 7 times full power on the chin. He seemed just fine. I hit Renzo with a grazing knee / thigh to the back of the head. And, you know, he suddenly lost all consciousness and control of his body.
But now, why would he have quit, though? Because at that point, he was, I think, ahead in the judges' scorecards. I would imagine he had kind of been able to control the fight to that point, having you on the ground. So,
controlling a fight and finishing a fight, you know, if you look at the Tito fight, Tito controlled the entire fight, or did he? You know, the fight is a race to the finish line, and Renzo was never going to get to the finish line. I could hear him breathing. I could feel the damage I was doing to him. He was never going to get to the finish line, and he needed a way out. And I got a lot of respect for Renzo. He's a great martial artist. But I know when a man is giving up, and I know when I've hurt somebody, and I didn't hurt that man. He gave up. And, you know, maybe I'm popular, and my opinion might not be popular, but I know the truth behind fighting. And I know the truth behind Renzo. The truth is he gave up. So when you hurt somebody, they go soft. When you hurt somebody, really hurt them, you know, the brain turns off a little bit. It protects itself. He didn't go soft. He didn't do anything. He looked for the knee hit him, and then he looked for a way out.
More like a crafty veteran move, in your opinion, kind of.
Yeah. Hey, you know what? I have all the respect for him in the world for finding a way to beat me, because he found a way.
All right. Well, so have you any word on where that fight might take place? Because where is it you're who you're talking with? Are you still on? I guess it must be talking to Strike Force if you're fighting Kung Lee. That's the San Jose promotion. Are you still talking to Pro Elite? I mean, where's your status and who you're looking to do business with?
No, I'm pretty much talking to everybody but the UFC. And I'm in the business of trying to grow MMA, not take advantage and monopolize the sport. And I'm in the business of promoting and building stars, not taking advantage of them. So I'm thinking that, you know, the bigger these shows get, we're going to need 2 or 3 of these promotions to compete against shows like the UFC.
Well, what about the IFL? I mean, you're both coaches in the IFL, so is that a natural place for that to happen?
Yeah, it would be fantastic. You know, the IFL is just short on bucks these days. So I think it's a fiscal issue for them to be able to afford the fight. But, you know, I don't discount anybody out. I love doing business. I love being a businessman and a fighter. And as far as I'm concerned, if you're working for the sport, I'll do business with you. If you're working against the sport, you know, I got nothing for you.
Now, in terms of the landscape of MMA right now, you have Pro Elite on Showtime, you've got the IFL, you've got UFC. what's your take on the landscape right now? Is it mainly just UFC dominated in your eyes, or where do you see the growth coming in the next few years?
Well, I think the growth is in the mainstream media. And you know, the UFC has a stranglehold on MMA and has totally monopolized it through a lot of good tactics and through a lot of bad tactics. But you know, it's just, you know, they're the 1,000-pound juggernaut, and everybody else is, you know, the 100-pound, you know, speedsters. Unfortunately, they got first mover advantage, and they've got, you know, the Fertitta brothers got more money than God, and you know, they're going to be a tough one to fight. But I don't even think about them. I don't care about them. I'm really focused on MMA as a lifestyle for the world and to do something positive with the sport. And, you know, if it involves them, great. If it doesn't, great. I don't care.
Well, does it involve a reality show, Frank? Because if I remember correctly, a couple months ago, there was a press release put out about tryouts for a reality show, and I never really heard anything more about it, but it seemed to be coming from your neck of the woods. Is there a reality show on the horizon for you?
You are a very keen man. We shot a presentation piece for a major network, of which I can't tell you which that network is. And it is currently titled Frank Shamrock's School of Hard Knocks. It's about the martial arts lifestyle that we live through our gym and turning youth around and other people around using mixed martial arts as a positive thing in their lives. I have no doubt it will be on a major network within the next 6 months.
So we're not talking about a Tough House or an Ultimate Fighter House where guys are locked up with alcohol and nothing to do, and so they turn on each other. This is a slightly more, sounds like a more martial arts-oriented, more positive presentation of the sport then.
Well, it's what I really do and what my community really is. And what those idiots do on the UFC reality show is not reality, and it's not martial arts. And it's doing nothing for the community of our sport. It's doing wonderful things for the popularity of it. But eventually someone's going to go, why are we beating each other up in a cage again? And if we don't have some soul in what we're doing, it's going to go away like it's gone away every 50 years for the past, you know, 500 years. So I just think that, you know, everybody's happy because the sport's popular, and I'm really excited about it. But, you know, what are we teaching our kids? Live in a house, get wasted, get tattoos, fight in the streets, and then maybe you'll be in the UFC.
So,
throw some steroids and pot in too.
So why don't you talk about a little bit about what your vision is then? I mean, what is the reason that young men are getting in the cage and fighting, and where do the martial arts factor back in to mixed martial arts? Because it started out as a martial arts competition. It's now evolved into a sport or perhaps a spectacle. How would you like to see it swing back?
Well, it's definitely a spectacle being presented as a sport. And you know what? The truth behind what we're doing is these people are extraordinary people. Anybody who's willing to dedicate themselves to a lifestyle of martial discipline and training and honor and respect, and then go out and bury their soul in front of their friends and their family and their community, that's an extraordinary person. And that same person, you know, 2,000 years ago would have been the lead warrior of a community or a clan, or would have been the guy you look up to in your little, you know, tribe. You know, I think that mindset of those people is just extraordinary. And that shouldn't be exploited and used. That should be honored. And, you know, I got all these kids coming in now who are 8 to 13 years old, and they just want to be those guys on TV. And the sad part is that's a horrible representation of our art. The art of fighting is the art of living. We wake up every day and we fight. We fight to be successful. We fight to find love. We fight for our families. And, you know, it's okay that we fight for sport or for art or whatever, but there's got to be some community. There's got to be some moral fiber to it. Otherwise, it's just going to go down the drain.
All right. I appreciate that, Frank. But before we go, I know we're kind of running up on – you don't have all night with us, unfortunately. So I know we're kind of running up on our limit here. But before you go, I want to take you way back in time now, because I think one of my favorite fights that very few people get to see very often was you versus Ensign Inoue in Japan. Valley Tudo 97.
97, yeah.
Now, that fight, I think, set a standard for, I guess, bringing intensity on the feet and fighting on the ground and combining them all. I guess it really set a standard for years to come. Is it just me, or do other people talk to you about that fight? And what kind of effect did that have on your career before you became UFC champion, before you went to the UFC?
Well, that, here's a piece of trivia. The winner of that fight was going to fight Kevin Jackson for the first ever middleweight title. So not only was, you know, the fight on the line, but the person who won that fight was going to be, you know, have a chance to fight the undefeated 1992 Olympic gold medalist for the middleweight championship belt. A huge moment in mixed martial arts, which most people don't even realize. That fight was the fight where I honestly thought that as hard as I was fighting, I might actually die in that fight. And I looked in my soul and accepted that moment. And went, if I'm going to die, I'm going to die like this. And that's my attitude towards that fight. And this is everyone who watches that fight comments on. Everybody who watches that fight, it touches them in a way. Because you can see inside my soul, and you can see me question myself, and you can see me make the decision that it's all or none. And that's how the fight was.
Yeah, and I guess
everyone has ever seen it, it's changed them in a small way.
Yeah, and I guess what made that great was not only what I guess you looking in your own soul, but it looked like Ensign did the same thing because that guy laid it all out on the line, and just the two of you bared everything.
Yeah, he did the same thing. And if you talk to Ensign now, he will tell you the most important moment in all of his fighting was that moment there. And it was the same for me. That's when I knew that I was going to do this for the rest of my life and that I was going to protect the sport and represent it in an honorable way. Because when you go through something like that with somebody or with your own self, you become a different person at the end of it. And I think it was the beginning of true mixed martial arts. I just want to put the martial arts back in mixed martial arts because everybody's forgotten about it.
Well, I'll tell you what, Frank, I wish you good luck in bringing the martial arts back into mixed martial arts. I think for Zach and I both, we thank you very much for taking the time out of your day. I know a 12-hour workday, and you've got a very busy schedule, I know, because we have to coordinate with, I think, two or three people to find you and get to track you down. But we were able to do it, so we...
I was just going to say thanks, guys. I appreciate, you know, not only the support, but, you know, you guys being straight up.
All right, very good. All right, well, everybody, that is Frank Shamrock, and this is Fight Opinion Radio, and we'll be back in just a minute.
You can be a hero for our troops currently deployed to active duty. The life of a deployed soldier is an important and vital job. It requires a lot of sacrifice while they're away from their families and loved ones for extended periods of time. This is your chance to contribute and lighten their day. Heroes for Heroes is a non-profit organization that collects all sorts of entertainment media and sends them to our troops overseas. Comic books, DVDs, CDs, games, and money for purchasing this media are all valid donations. Each one of these are vital to supporting the morale of all of our deployed military personnel and are collected by Heroes for Heroes for redistribution. Heroes for Heroes is a non-profit organization, and their site is heroes4heroes.org. You can donate money on their site, volunteer your time to help them pack and ship items out, or simply mail them your entertainment media directly so it can be redistributed to the field. Again, the site is heroes4heroes.org. Become a hero for all our military heroes currently deployed.
Former UFC middleweight champion Rich A. Franklin wants his title back.
Relentless is Franklin.
But he'll have to get through the fearsome offense of the man who dethroned him, Anderson Spider Silva.
Oh, with a big shot.
It is all
over. The rematch with Anderson Silva is a chance for redemption, and it's going to be a war.
Silva ventures to Franklin's backyard to defend his title in hostile territory. Also, fast-rising heavyweight contender Brandon the Truth Vera.
Moves his way to victory!
It's time to put up or shut up. Let's find out what the truth's made of, and don't believe the hype, just believe what you see.
Vera faces his toughest challenge yet in former UFC heavyweight champion Jim the Maniac Sylvia. The Ultimate Fighting Championship presents UFC 77, Hostile Territory, live Saturday, October 20th from U.S. Bank Arena in Cincinnati, Ohio, only on pay-per-view.
Hey, everybody, this is Caleb from the Fightworks Podcast, and you're locked in to Fight Opinion Radio.
If you've ever wanted to learn more about Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu or submission grappling, then check out the Fightworks podcast, where we interview the biggest names out there today, from classic BJJ personalities to up-and-coming forces in mixed martial arts. Check us out at thefightworkspodcast.com. Okay, family, keep training and keep listening to Fight Opinion Radio with Zach Arnold.
Opinion Radio.
We are back indeed, and I'm counting all the money I've made from the last segment.
You know what? I bet you're not counting all your money as much as Zufa's counting its money, because they seem to have, one way or another, come into a lot of moolah lately.
Yeah, what's this $350 million? I mean, I only got $200 million from FightOpinion.com.
Well, I'll tell you what. I could sit here all day and tell you about the $350 million, but why don't we bring in somebody who could actually know a little bit about this, a little more than we do at least. And we're going to bring in Jeremy Goodwin. He's a CPA, licensed in New Hampshire, works out of Massachusetts, a Fight Opinion reader and listener. And Jeremy, you're going to help us walk through this $350 million that Zufa seems to have gotten recently.
Yeah, I'll do my best.
All right. Well, welcome on the show, Jeremy.
Thank you.
All right. Well, we're very happy you could join us. Now, Jeremy, this is all coming up, this $350 million in loans and credit that UFC got. This is big news, but it's kind of news that flew under the radar. And the only reason we seem to be talking about it today is because this week, Standard & Poor's, which is a credit rating bureau, gave a credit rating, I guess, update on Zufa that got made it into the news wires. What is it that UFC's taken out in terms of these loans, and why is that credit rating being reported by a company like Standards & Poor's?
Zufa currently has two loans that we're aware of. One of them is a $25 million revolving loan, and the other is a $325 million Term B loan. So typically...
But okay, so just to get the leaders right on point, our listeners right on point, what is a revolving loan and what is a term loan?
A revolving loan is essentially similar to a credit card. Basically, you borrow against the loan, and then interest is rolled into the loan, and you make payments on the loan later that reduce the outstanding balance on the loan. So the $25 million is actually a ceiling on the amount they can borrow.
Right. So just like a credit card, you could borrow it, pay it off for as long as that loan, as that line of credit remains open.
Yep.
Okay, now what is a term loan?
A term loan is a loan that is due at the end of the loan period. Typically, when a company borrows a large term loan, they're usually able to roll that loan into another new loan at the end of the loan's life.
Uh-huh. So they may not be paid off.
Basically, yeah, it may not ever be paid off.
So in the corporate world, those kind of things kind of roll over. As long as you're paying the interest on the loan, people are happy. And now, which people are happy? And this kind of gets to why is this being reported? UFC has a $325 million loan, a $25 million line of credit. Why does anybody know about this? And how has this become something that Standard & Poor's is interested in?
Zufa goes to their bank, and they obtain this loan. Then the bank turns around and turns those loans. They recoup the value of the loan from investors. They sell the loans as packages of securities. So those securities are traded on the open market at a discount, the same way a bond would be traded.
Right. So let's say so if I understand that correctly, Jeremy, let's say, just to make it easier numbers, or make real numbers, Zufa gets a $325 million loan from a bank at an interest rate of whatever it is, X. And then the bank goes ahead and takes that loan and maybe combines it with a few others or maybe not, and then goes out on the market and sells parts of that loan to reduce its risk, and other people buy it because they're going to get paid some of the interest on the loan.
Right, exactly.
Right, so very good. So that means... this is a way for Zufa, if I'm understanding this correctly, Jeremy, this is a way for Zuffa to cash in on it, on the value it's created in its company through the open securities market, but avoid the scrutiny and the hassle and the reporting that goes with becoming a publicly traded company. So instead of selling the company itself and its shares, they sell debt in the company, and so they still own it and control it, yet they're kind of getting the benefit of being in the securities market.
Right, exactly. Companies can choose to finance their activities in a couple of different ways, and basically the two main forms for companies that are trying to raise more cash are to either sell stock, which grants the holders of that stock rights related to the way that the, you know, deciding how the company is going to be run and claims on their future income. So they get dividends, they get payments out of their net income at the end of the year. Whereas debt doesn't carry that kind of baggage. You know, you have to pay interest, but you know upfront what you're going to end up having to pay out, and you're able to keep control of the company.
All right, so now we know what's going on. Zuffa's taking out loans. They're being sold on the open market by the bank or the financial institution that granted them the loans. And therefore, because they're being sold on the open market, people are evaluating Zuffa's credit worthiness. What was the evaluation that the Standard & Poor's firm came out with this week? And did you get a chance to review it?
Standard & Poor's is just one of many firms that evaluates this sort of securities. In this case, in the specific case of Standard & Poor's, they have a letter grading system that ranges from AAA down to D. The AAA rating means that the company is in no immediate risk and they have no long-term risks that are associated with them. So you basically are guaranteed to be able to get your money back when you buy their securities. Zuffa has a BB rating, and the BB rating signifies that the company doesn't have any problems right now and doesn't have kind of longer-term problems that are definitely known right now, but there is some kind of volatility in their industry that could cause them a problem in the future. For instance, if MMA was suddenly banned in the United States, Zuffa would have a lot of trouble trying to pay back their loans.
What's significant about being a BB rating, Jeremy, is that BB rating is the best rating for a speculative credit rating. In other words, it's the best rating in its group, but it falls, instead of being, I guess, what you would consider I don't know what you consider the top level of paper. I don't know exactly the term, but it becomes speculative once it hits a BB rating.
Right. Instead of being essentially a sure thing, there's a possibility, since it's labeled speculative, there's some possibility that it may not be repaid. Therefore, the risk that's involved in buying them is higher. And that means that when you resell that kind of security, you're able to increase the effective rate of interest because you can sell it at a lower price.
So it affects the rate at which they sell it. Now, when they came out with the rating this week, the rating stayed BB, which it has been, but something else changed in the rating.
S&P, while they say the word is reiterated, their current guidance, which is a BB rating, they also indicated that they had some degree of concern that the company's rating might be decreased in the future. And the reason that they gave was that the company's recent events held in the UK didn't do as well as were anticipated.
Aha. So, Zach, this is I guess, the first bit of financial news we've gotten about the UFC, about what their finances are like. And the first news we get, is that the shows in the UK are not as profitable as the people who provide their credit ratings expected.
Yeah, not only that, but also it's taken them a lot more money to establish their presence in the UK. And also, additionally, we found out that they used some of this money to finance the Pride asset sale and also to pay a dividend to themselves.
Right. So when we looked up, when we did our research online, Zach, and looking at everything, what we found was that the justification published on through the rating service explaining why they took the loan was there a number of justifications or several. One was they wanted to use it to to fund the Pride asset purchase, which, as we know, was going to be well below $350 million, and that was even before they did the due diligence and found out they were buying nothing. And then a second reason was to fund the company's just general operations, I believe. And then a third reason is that they were going to pay a dividend or just pay some of that money straight to the owner's pockets.
Yeah, and Jeremy, I want to ask you, you know, given the large amount of money that these two loans have, $350 million, when you look at that kind of figure, you know, isn't that a little bit alarming if you're a UFC fan, if you're sitting there going, they're having to take out this much money in loans? Aren't they making money hand over fist? I mean, what's the situation?
Well, just to qualify for that amount of loan under what's called Term B, the company has to have a pretty significant amount of income already. The kind of baseline qualification is to have $40 million in net income before interest, depreciation, taxes, and amortization.
What does that mean?
They are making quite a bit of money.
That means... That means, if I understood Jeremy, that means if you just took the amount of money they took in for all their operations, subtracted the expenses, but then didn't subtract some of this other tax and book consequences, things like writing down the goodwill value of the company. If you just looked on a cash flow basis, that means on a cash flow basis, if I heard you right, they made at least $100 million.
Yeah, that's basically right.
Wow. Zach, this is it.
$40 million. I'm sorry.
$40 million. But no, they made at least $40 million. But then we had some further information. Is that correct?
Yeah.
From Moody's that indicated that it might be substantially more than $40 million.
You're talking up to $100 million, which is incredible. And
Jeremy, when you looked at it, it's at least $40 million to qualify for the loan. But the reason I brought up the $100 million number was because if you looked at Moody's, which is another ratings company,
right? Exactly. They come to that one third.
And they gave us some information that their debt will improve to being under 3x debt to this EBITDA, this number we talked about earlier, which tells you that it's at least, if you told me correctly, at least $100 million?
Right. The calculation comes out to a bit more than $100 million in EBITDA.
Right. So that means in terms of just pure cash flow, Zach, when people tell us that the UFC is doing well, but maybe not that well, or they've had a lot of time, money to recover, you know, because they put out a lot of money in the beginning of their operations. This is now a very cash-rich company, Zach.
It's an amazing operation that they've got funded there right now. And considering that they're in Nevada with no state income tax and all the business-friendly legislation in that state and all the casino money they already have and all the access to everything they've got, I don't know how anyone can stop them.
Jeremy, if you ran the UFC, you'd be a very wealthy man today, wouldn't you?
Quite possibly, but I'd also be very wealthy before I started running the UFC.
Why is that?
Because the Zuffers have casino interests.
Ah, I got you. All right. But their buddy Dana may not have had the casino interests. But this is, I guess, Jeremy, give me some perspective. This for us in the world of mixed martial arts is huge news. We now have the news that Zuffa is taking out $350 million in loans and lines of credit. And we have the news that the numbers that we're getting from the rating services calculate that they made on a cash, in terms of cash in and cash out, probably a little more than $100 million. That's what the calculations seem to indicate, although none of us can have seen their books, but that's what it looks like based on what's been reported. Give us some perspective, though. For us, those are staggering numbers. But in the business world, in the security world, are they big fish or are they small fish in a big pond?
Well, they're certainly much larger than some of the other MMA organizations are out there. In the case of the IFL, they've lost quite a bit of money, but they haven't spent anywhere near $100 million in their entire existence, let alone made $100 million. They're nowhere near as big as IBM, but they're a quite solid company in terms of their size and the amount of revenue they're bringing in.
Right. So I guess in the MMA world, this confirms what we've always known, Zach. They are the big dogs. But I guess
nobody else has even come close to them. I mean, you have to look at it in perspective. When Pride was making money in their peak years in like 04 and 05, I mean, they were making $50 million. I mean, that was considered a lot of money.
But it is Zuffa, a lot of money.
Zuffa making $100 million after everything else is taken out, that's pretty incredible.
Yeah, and then I guess, Jeremy, but I guess before people go, overboard on all this. In the corporate world, a $350 million loan on a company with a $100 million cash flow sounds like a lot, but in the world of large corporations, it's really not that remarkable.
No, the company basically has until, about halfway into the next decade to pay this back.
Oh, okay. So, wait. Let's go there. What is the date that this money becomes due? Did we mention that yet? I don't think we have.
No, I don't believe we mentioned it.
So when is the money due, Jeremy?
One of the loans is due in 2012, and one of them is due in 2015.
Okay, so they have, like you were saying, until the middle of the next decade to pay this money back, and now they have the money flush in their pockets to expand and line their pockets if they choose.
Exactly.
Wow. Well, this is significant now. Zach, let me ask you a question about this. What does this mean when fighters like Matt Hughes say that Zuffa's taking very good care of me, but they're no longer paying percentage of the pay-per-view revenue to fighters? They don't do it anymore. And you look at the payroll on the fighters for the fighters that are getting through these shows, and it's not that significant compared to the income that the Zuffa is making. Is this strengthening the case that the fighters are worth more money?
I would agree so with that, although I'm surprised that if it's true that they still cut the percentage out for the pay-per-view main eventers, although if it is true, it's not a good move because eventually someone's going to come in and pluck some of these guys away, and UFC's going to have to build up more stars. The question is for UFC, is it going to cost them more to keep the guys they have, or is it going to cost them more to build up new names?
Jeremy, you're not a fight promoter, but you are a person who's very familiar with numbers. Is this to you lend credence to the argument that I've made repeatedly that the fighters need to have competing promotions out there to get paid what they're worth? Because it seems to me that Zuffa is taking more than the lion's share of the profits here.
Well, that may be what you see from the raw numbers, but you need to remember that EBITDA excludes amortization, which is going to be a major expense for Zuffa because they have a lot of what's called intangible assets. They have brands, they have fighter contracts, and those expenses are not included in the EBITDA calculations. So instead, they're kind of doled out over a period of years. So they're going to recognize those expenses over time, but they're not included in that calculation of their net income.
Okay, so what kind of things wouldn't be included? We got fighter contracts, which I think have to be included during each show. So that would be accounted for at least partially in the cash flow, right?
Yeah, it would depend
on the contract itself.
Term of the contract.
Right.
Yeah.
And then what other kind of things would be there that could significantly affect this $100 million number, typically? Because none of us know. I guess we should make this clear. We have already before, but let's make it clear again. None of us have seen Zuffa's numbers. We're basing this on what we're getting from the wires and the credit reporting services. But typically, in your experience as a CPA, what other kind of things could affect that $100 million number?
Well, typically a big factor would be taxes, but because of the structure of Zuffa, since it's a limited liability company, taxes are kind of paid by the investors as they come due. So the company itself doesn't bear any tax burden.
But it's going to have to pay out, let's say, because it's no state tax, but somewhere in the 35% range to the owners of the company to account for their federal tax that they incur for the company, right?
Right. The owners will pay that tax themselves because they're going to be allocated the income of the company.
And normally, it's almost unheard of for a company like Zuffa not to pay that money to the owners so that they can cover their taxes.
I would imagine. That is kind of typical, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So we have taxes that knock it down by 35%. We have fighter contracts that may knock that down. And what else might knock it down?
Typically, another number would be depreciation, but Zuffa probably doesn't have very much in the way of tangible assets. They probably don't own a whole lot of buildings. They certainly don't own any fighting arenas. Most of what they own is in the form of these intangible assets. Mm-hmm. So that's not a number that you're going to worry about in your calculation.
Well, so I guess it looks like really, no matter how we cut it, Zach, they got a ton of money. And I guess to sum up, this is all kind of very complicated. It has to do a lot with accounting and securities and loans and amortizations and all these things and the EBITDA. But it's all very complicated. But Zach and Jeremy, the bottom line here is Zuffa has given itself $325 million cash. They've taken out a loan for that amount. They have a line of credit anytime they want to touch it of up to $25 million. They're looking at about $100 million in revenue on a cash flow basis in terms of money in and money out. And nobody else is reporting it, but you're getting all that news direct here on Fight Opinion.
Absolutely, and I feel smarter for talking to Jeremy.
Yeah, well, you know, it always helps to have a smart guy on the show once in a while. Well, listen,
how dare you?
Jeremy.
Yes.
Thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate you helping us understand this. Neither Zach or I are accountants, and generally when people like me go to law school, it's because we're not good with numbers. So I definitely appreciate you taking the time to join us tonight and let Jeremy, I guess this is a lesson for all listeners and readers. If you enjoy Fight Opinion and you can contribute, we love to have you contribute.
Thanks for having me on, and I'm glad that I've been able to confuse absolutely everybody out there.
Well, I'm not confused, at least not any more than I normally am. All right, well, that is it. That is the breakdown on the UFC's finances, and when we come back, Zach, guess what we got?
The world-famous grab bag, the highest quarter-hour rated segment in all of MMA radio.
Excellent. And so, everybody stay tuned. We'll be back with the grab bag, Fight Opinion Radio.
Okay, move the band here. Yeah, that's very nice. That's very nice. Okay, all right, hurry up. Okay, put that over there. Oh, no. Oh, jeez. No, careful with that. All right, ready? Set that up. Action. What can you find at Cockatoo.com?
Fresh opinions.
Very informative segments.
Plus, tons of original content.
Plus our store of Japanese fight goods and Cockatoo Fan Radio. So check us out at www.kakuto.com.
It's not easy being an MMA fan. Your annoying brother-in-law, who's been watching MMA since Ultimate Fighter Season 5, continues to claim that he knows more about fighting than you.
I hate to tell you this, buddy, but I think Royce Gracie's gonna be the next champ. You know he's the best heavyweight ever.
Well, we can't help that he married your sister, but we can make your brother-in-law shut his fat pie hole about how he knows MMA better than you. At MMAPredictions.com, you can track your predictions against that jerk over time and see graphs showing which of you really knows the sport. You can even create groups among your buddies to talk smack. Use it for the guys at the office, your gym, or your girlfriend's book club. Be careful, though.
Woo! I won again!
MMAPredictions.com. Pick. Share. Compare. Win.
Looking to buy a ring for your wrestling, boxing, or MMA promotion?
Unleash a monster!
Are you looking for a cage, steel security rails, vinyl canvas and mat covers, a ring belt, or a ring trailer?
Unleash a monster!
Are you looking for a 6- or 8-sided ring? Do you want your own custom design?
Unleash a monster!
Monster Wrestling and Boxing Rings is your complete source for all kinds of rings and accessories. If your business is wrestling, boxing, or MMA, if you need a complete ring, a custom design, or even a do-it-yourself kit, then
Unleash a Monster.
Monster rings are used by large promotions, independent promotions, training centers, movie studios, television companies, video game companies, churches, government agencies, nightclubs, bars, youth leagues, martial arts studios, and individuals around the world. Monster Rings sells more rings than all their competitors combined. So,
Unleash a Monster.
Head to MonsterWrestlingRings.com and explore all the options. Forget the rest. Buy from the best. MonsterWrestlingRings.com.
Unleash a monster.
Today.
It's grab bag time. Hello, Zach.
You sound melodic.
I know, I'm excited. It's time for the most exciting, fast-paced, interesting segment in all of MMA radio.
Very ubiquitous.
Ubiquitous, appearing everywhere at once? No, only appears here, and only at specific times.
Very unique.
There you go, it's unique. All right, it is time for the world-famous grab bag, where we all pick a topic, but I guess today it'll be we each pick a topic. Maybe I'll pick two, just to, you know, throw...
Why, because you're a glory hog?
Yeah, because we don't have Aaron with us, we should you know, in her honor.
Oh, you're going to overcompensate?
Exactly. I'm going to overcompensate.
Okay, go ahead.
I will start and I will end it this time.
Oh, Okay, go ahead.
I will start with the news that the Zuffa, the owners of the Ultimate Fighting Championships, have gone after a website called UFCTakedown.com and forced them to change their name to MMAtakedown.com.
Why am I not surprised?
I'm not surprised either, although, you know, you have sites like UFC Mania. They changed their name quietly, right?
Well, that was UFC Junkie.
Yeah, UFC Junkie. What was it? UFC Mania is still there, right?
Yes.
Somehow they continue to exist. Why is UFC – the question was raised by Luke over at BloodyElbowBox.com. Why are they going after sites like UFCTakedown.com, making them change their name? Because the UFC is in the title. Why are they going after people who have videotapes or videos of the shows, yet they don't go after everybody who talks about the UFC or says UFC on their site? It seems like if they go after one, they would be going after everybody. And so to clear it up for people, what's going on here, Zuffa owns a trademark, or probably more likely a service mark, in the name UFC. What does that mean, Zach? When you have a trademark or a service mark, it means that you have the right to use that name in business, and no other business or person can use that name in a way that would confuse people and make them believe that they are associated with you or that you're one and the same, right?
So yeah.
For example, UFC has the right in the name, you know, UFC for using it in mixed martial arts, but there might be some totally unrelated. It might be an accountant called Uberman Fitchin and Cohen. And it might be able to be the accountants UFC, right? If there's no likelihood of confusion, they might be able to have that right. But
okay.
Anybody in the MMA world is not going to be able to use the term UFC in a way that makes people think that they're associated with the UFC, so that website goes down. If you have, and then people ask, well, why are the videos going down? And that's because the UFC owns the copyright in the videos. If you own a copyright in the video, that means you have the right to prevent other people from publishing it and disseminating your videos without your permission. You can't just make copies and put them out on the internet. So they have the right to take down the videos. So the question Luke asked is, how come they're not stopping people if they have the right to the name and they have the copyright? How come they're not stopping people from using UFC in articles or on references to websites? And the answer is a little bit of legal trivia for you. Are you ready?
Sure.
If you have a trademark like UFC does Zuffa does in the name UFC, that means that you cannot have that same thing copyrighted. You have a choice. You can either copyright something or trademark it. So that means that UFC does not have the right to prevent people from using the word or the name UFC. They only have the right to prevent them from using it in a way that it confuses people as to believing that the way it's being used is from the actual UFC itself. So you and I are allowed to talk about the UFC or mention the UFC in an article, but we can't have the name of our website be WeRetheRealUFC.com.
Sure. Savvy marketplace confusion.
Right. Marketplace confusion. And that explains what happened with UFCTakedown.com.
Very eloquent on your part.
Thank you. What's your grab bag?
My grab bag is not so eloquent. It's more like a punch in the face, really. I mean, like J.C. Calvin. Have you seen J.C. Calvin?
Oh, man.
Have you
was
seen the beatdown he laid down on Vitor Shaolin Ribeiro?
That was impressive. That was beyond impressive.
He used his left hand, and he shoved this man. And we're talking about the Heroes Yokohama Arena event that happened on the 17th. He used his left hand, and he shoved this man down like he was a sack of potatoes and just beat him.
Unbelievable. Now you got
and then he faced Andre Gide in the main event, and he made pretty quick work of him too.
Jay-Z is extremely, extremely impressive. You know, Shaolin was in my top five in the world. So to have Jay-Z walk through him like that, unbelievably impressive.
Yeah,
I mean,
this is the second middleweight crown he's won, tournament he's won in a row in Heroes. He is probably their biggest star they've made, you know, their homegrown star that they've made. And again, you have to ask yourself, like Jake Shields, why is this guy not in the UFC?
Yeah, if I was the UFC, I'd love to have a fighter like him. He's very impressive. I guess, you know, though, to me, maybe it's a little bit healthy that some of these guys aren't in there. Not good for us in terms of fans wanting to see the best matchups. But, you know, maybe it's good in terms of the fact that there will be other promotions out there that can create interesting fights.
What makes him such a dangerous fighter is that he's gone through such high-level competition. When he's now likely going to face Takanori Gomi in K1 for New Year's Eve, and he should win that fight.
Yeah, based on Gomi's uneven performances.
I mean, this guy is going to be the next monster heel in Japan. He's going to be a huge star.
Well, that'll explain why he stays and doesn't go to the UFC then, right?
Right, but I mean, if you're UFC, you're sitting there going, we've let some of these guys in the Pride deal, you know, slip through the cracks. We haven't signed them, you know, and now they're going to come back to haunt us, and we're going to have a big mega power in Heroes, and they're going to use some of the top ATP guys and really make them in the stars. I mean, you think about JC Calvin for a second here.
Yes.
I mean, other than the one loss he had in a kickboxing match, get this, a kickboxing match against Masato, you know, other than that, I mean, he's really been dominant since the Heroes promotion started.
He's now the guy to beat, I really believe.
Yeah, and he's got a great look, good personality, just marketable to the gills. I think he is going to be a definitely a superstar to come. Absolutely.
All right, hey, why don't you come up with another grab bag real quick?
Okay, let's talk. Let's talk here about MMA because, you know, Jeremy, in the interview we had with him earlier, he's talking about one of the things that could really hurt, you know, Zuffa is if MMA gets banned.
Mm-hmm. But that's, you know, not happening. No way. We're on a roll. Everybody's recognizing us and commissions are coming online. That could never happen.
Except the city of Vancouver, Canada.
What?
They decided to ban MMA on Thursday.
Who?
Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, one of the biggest Canadian cities.
Oh, goodness gracious. Well, that's not very good news.
And home to Bodog.
And home to Bodog. Not good news.
Home to Calvin Air.
That's not good news. Now, I got to tell you, in my estimation, I don't see this becoming a trend, but it's definitely not good.
Well, you have the stupid British Medical Association. You have the Australian Medical Association trying to ban MMA in Perth, which is Western Australia. And now you've got Vancouver coming out and banning MMA.
All right. Maybe you are onto a beginning of a very bad trend. I guess the second coming of the McCain, John McCain. I mean, you know, where he got MMA knocked off of cable television because it was too brutal. They went ahead and repaired the sports repaired itself and embraced regulation. And now,
and I know what happens when there is no regulation.
Where,
the shows are going to continue. They're just not going to be in the areas that are regulated.
Yep. All right. Well, that's a downer to end on the show on. But I think overall, Zach, this was a pretty interesting show.
This is a fantastic show. Full of variety.
Yeah, full variety. We had an interview with one of the most legendary fighters in MMA history. We broke down a couple major events over the last week. We, I think, are the first people to really delve into the news as to what's going on with the UFC finances and their $350 million in loans and lines of credit and their $100 million in cash flow this last year. And we had a world-famous grab bag.
Plus, this was a real man show with no estrogen whatsoever.
Plus, we didn't even get a chance to talk about the fact that Pro Elite bought Icon and King of the Cage and Cage Rage. Those deals are all done. This is just... That's how bad jam-packed we were.
They spent a lot of money, didn't they?
Yeah,
I think
sure
they spent as much money as Aaron at a shopping mall.
You know what? If they had $100 million in revenue, brilliant. I just hope they got the money to fund operations after all these purchases.
Yeah, brutal.
Brutal, but beautiful show nonetheless. Zach, say goodnight.
Good night, all.
You stay classy, Internet.
And thanks for stopping by.
Oh, you son of a... You know, Aaron's not even here. You have to play that game now? You have to
and
go one up?
And thanks for stopping by.
Oh, rough. Goodbye, y'all.